The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Being mindfulness and I guess dharma in a secular way into San Quentin, into state prisons. He's a remarkable man. He's given a few talks here before, and I think a number of people feel like they're the most moving talks ever given here at our center. Quite powerful. And sometimes he comes with some of his men. He comes with to give his talks together with some of men who have been released from San Quentin, who've gone through his program and have been transformed in the process. And it's quite remarkable to meet these people. So he's coming on next Sunday, and then he's coming back again in, about 2 weeks later, on Saturday the 20th. We've offered our building, our center, for him, for his organization. He has an organization called Inside Out, which is kind of what supports his activities. He's now kind of expanding his work beyond San Quentin into the other prisons in the state, very actively involved, and he remarkably has the ear of all the wardens in the state of California. So that's something. And he's met with all of them as a group a couple of times, and he's training people to go into the prisons. And he's also involved with setting up programs for men who are on parole. So we offered a building here as a benefit for him, for his organization, and he's put together what I think is going to be a phenomenal day that he and some of his men that he has trained will come, San Quentin people will come here and offer a taste of how mindfulness practice can be applied and used in a situation where it is... it needs to work. You know, it has to have results in a way that, you know, some people, you know, it should have results for all of us, but some of us can take our time. And then apparently he's also going to bring in the afternoon members of, I guess now former members, I don't know, members of the San Quentin Choir. So it's going to be quite an event. And so it's a benefit, and so there's a suggested donation as part of it. I'd like to see it be very successful. I want to support Jacques. If you know of anybody who would make sense to invite and encourage to come, anybody who's remotely interested in this topic of prison or jail practice, dharma, or anybody who is living in prison of their own minds, I think it should be quite and been involved. Also, part of this day is also to address some of the issues around violence. Any of you have been touched by violence, this is apparently going to be quite a meaningful time to look at this. So that's the 20th of June. And then before that, on the 13th of June, the week before, the week before that, the 13th of July, Diana Clark and I are going to do a Sati Center kind of study day, a Sutta study day, looking at three discourses of the Buddha in a nice way, I think. Some of you who like that kind of study are welcome to come. Okay. So what I'd like to talk about today is one of the core teachings of Buddhism that is shared by almost all schools of Buddhism. So it's nice to know what we have in common with other Buddhists. And this is a teaching or principle that is called, sometimes called in English, dependent arising, conditioned arising, dependent co-arising. It comes up in different words, different terms. The Pali word is paticca samuppada. And it can be seen as the first principle or the beginning principle out of which Buddhist teachings and practice arise. And as such, it can be seen as an abstraction, as a general abstraction or principle. And sometimes it's useful, though, to begin with abstractions, with principles, as a background, and then learn how to apply them in our lives, to see how they apply in the moment, their relevance in the actual experience of our life. And really the test of principles, the test of general teachings, is not in the generalities. It's easy to debate the philosophy of it, but rather the test is it applicable in the moment-to-moment experience here and now? So, you know, I offer it as a kind of a first principle of Buddhism, as opposed to what in some religions start maybe with a first cause. And so what's, you know, the origin of the universe, God created it all, that's all the beginning. Buddhism doesn't begin with a first cause, with a cosmic beginning of it all, but rather begins with a principle that is meant to address a particular issue. And so we could say the more central than the first principle is the first problem that Buddhism tries to address. And the first problem is that of suffering. Suffering, the word dukkha, is a very broad term. Maybe suffering is not even the best translation of the word dukkha. Some people translate it as stress, some people as unsatisfactoriness. One Zen teacher translated it as anguish. But somehow dukkha, that the suffering is kind of a problem that we want to address. And so that in addressing that problem, we have to have some way in, some place to begin our explorations. And the suggestion in Buddhism is we begin with this principle of dependent arising. It's an unusual place to begin for many people in the West, because I've encountered many people who grew up in the kind of Judeo-Christian mindset, even if they don't feel like they belong to those religions. The orientation for religion, often in the West, is so strongly focused on a relationship that's something external to oneself. There's a relationship to God. There's a relationship to heaven, to hell. Somehow the focus on the external relationship is so strong that sometimes when I've tried to have kind of dialogues with people of other religions, they're perplexed by my presentation of Buddhism. It just doesn't make any sense that that's where it's about, because Buddhism doesn't posit something that the primary function or place or activity of religious life is in a relationship to a deity. Relationship to something external out there, something transcendent, some heavenly realm that you hope to get born in, or a hell realm you try to avoid. And so it's kind of, what is Buddhism then if it doesn't have that? I mean, can it really be a religion? And more deeply for some, even if people don't believe in heaven, hell, or God, there's such a strong conditioning that religion has to do with a relationship to something outside. And so some people then will posit that there's some kind of benign love or benign force in the universe that we relate to that relates to us because of this need to have something, you know, some explanation, some connection to something. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, criticize these things. It just makes it hard with that kind of orientation to understand what Buddhism is trying to teach. And that Buddhism, in focusing on this first principle of dependent co-arising, is really pointing the finger back to us. If there is a first cause, it's with us, in us. Not the first cause of the universe, but the first cause or the origin of the problem, which is suffering. If we have this relationship model to try to understand our suffering, then we'll look outside of ourselves for a solution. For example, in a theistic religion, it has to do with your relationship to God or gods, that somehow we have to get that relationship set just right. And then somehow in that having that relationship right, the problems of human life are settled and taken care of. If it's not a matter of, a God, it might be some external reality or cosmic principle out there, they have to figure out and learn and tune into. Some people, they focus on meditation would be to use meditation, the altered states of meditation, in order to have a relationship or to tune into or tap into some larger reality, transcendent reality in this world, kind of outside, which is outside of ourselves, which will take care of ourselves if we just kind of tap into it. Everything will be okay if we have this tap into this larger thing. But I think the teaching of dependent origination, because ideas keep pointing back to us. Buddhism has this tremendous, these fingers, not pointing at the moon, as they say in Zen, but rather always pointing back to us, to understand ourselves, understand how we function, what goes on for us, how our contribution to our own suffering. Not because Buddhism is meant to be selfish or to be self-focused, but rather because by turning the attention inward, selfishness gets dissolved. By turning its focus inward, there's a way in which we go in order to be able to go out again and connect to the wider world without some of the attachments and clingings and problems that we just bring with us when we go and engage in the world around us. So dependent co-arising. There's a story that the tradition gives that kind of to emphasize the importance of this. The two primary disciples of the Buddha were monks by the name of Sariputta and Mahamogliana. And the story has to do with how they discovered the Dharma, how they woke up. And the story starts with saying that they grew up as friends in neighboring villages, so they knew each other growing up. They were Brahmins, which means that they were kind of the priest class of the time, which also meant that they were probably much more educated than most people, because part of what Brahmins do is they grew up being educated in the Brahmanical lore, in the texts, the so-called science of the times, the knowledges of the time. And as such, they grew up, became adults, and were well-respected, and in fact had some students of their own. And then every year in their village, in their part of the country, there was a festival, a three-day festival called the Hilltop Festival. And they were given nice seats at the festival to watch the festivities. And they enjoyed themselves the first 2 days of the festivities. And then came the third day, and perhaps after 2 days of partying, the third day of watching it all and being it, maybe kind of they were ready, their mind, to see it in a different way. And they were watching it, and it occurred to Sariputta, kind of fleetingly in his mind, somehow he was reminded or awoke to the mortality of life. So you can maybe imagine watching people partying in a wild way in a festival, that it's nice, but what's the juxtaposition of that with the fact that some of those people probably in the festival are going to be dead before next year? Some of them maybe sooner than that. And all of us are going to be dead sooner or later. From time to time, people will encounter the topic of mortality, and it causes a certain poignancy in their life. And kind of they look at what they're doing in their life from a different perspective. Is it really relevant, what they're doing? Is it valuable? Is it important? Sometimes this can happen really close to death, where things that seem important at other times start losing their value, and they don't seem as important anymore. And sometimes it can happen in one's youth, where something dramatic kind of wakes one up to this mortality. So this kind of happened. Somehow this happened to these two men. And they looked at each other, kind of, and they both kind of had the same thought at the same time and said, "What's going on with you? You don't look so happy or so involved anymore in the festivities." And they shared what was happening to them. And they said, "Yes, in the context of the fact that within 100 years, all of us, everyone here is going to be dead, maybe we should pursue something different than partying. And perhaps we can search for liberation." So they set off and wandered around, and they found a spiritual teacher, an ascetic, who they joined his group and engaged in his practices. So these are serious people. They're well-trained in the spiritual lore of their time. They engaged in serious practice and teachers of their time. And they came to a point, practicing with their teacher, that they had kind of mastered what he had to teach. done his practices, and they asked him, "Is this all you have?" And he said, "Yeah, this is all I have. You got it." And they said, "Well, we are still not liberated. This is not enough for us. So we'll go off." And so they went off wandering, and they ran in, within, I think, 6 months after the Buddha's enlightenment, they ran into one of the first five monks enlightened under the Buddha. They ran into him, and one of them, they made a pact. They said, they went off separately, said, whoever discovers awakening first comes and finds the other one and tells him. So Sariputta ran into this monk and was impressed by this monk's calm, his demeanor, the radiance of his face. There was something about his serenity and brightness that he had never seen in a person before. And so Sariputta said, "You know, who is your teacher and what are your teachings? What's going on with you?" And the man said, "Well, I'm a student, a disciple of the Buddha." And Sariputta said, "Well, what's his teachings?" And the man said, "Well, I'm just recently involved with the Buddha, and it's a profound teaching, but I don't really understand it well enough to explain it to you." And Sariputta said, "Well, I'm pretty smart." I don't know if it's said exactly that way. It's modern English colloquial way of saying it, translating it. But, you know, I'm capable. And why don't you just offer me what you understand in some kind of, in short, summary. And I'll fill it in, or I'll try to understand it from there. So the monk said to Sariputta, "The things that have a cause, my teacher teaches the cause. The things that have a cause, my teacher teaches the cessation of that cause. That's the teachings of the Buddha." And with that, Sariputta attained what's called the Dharma eye, his first glimpse of awakening. So, probably didn't happen to any of you listening to that. Oh, did? probably a majority of you, except for the few of you, maybe the majority of you, were probably, you know, what? Well, how is this important? Of the things that have a cause, the Buddha teaches the cause. Of the things that have a cause, the Buddha teaches the cessation of the cause. This is his teachings. What's that about? So this has to do with his teaching of dependent origination, conditioned arising. That things, certain things occur based on the existence of causes and conditions. Generally, it doesn't rain unless there's clouds. The clouds are the condition for the rain. And so we can point to many, many things in our lives that there has to be some condition in place for something else to occur. If it's raining and the clouds go away quickly, chances are the rain's going to stop quickly as well. Or if you're in Hawaii, the condition for the rain is the clouds have to be above you. And when the clouds move, it stops raining on you. They're no longer, the condition is they have to be above you, but you watch the rain go away down the street. So this teaching of dependent origination is summarized in a different way in the texts that goes something like this. With the arising of this, with the occurrence of this, that arises. With the existence of this, that exists as well. With the seizing of this, that ceases as well. When this does not exist, that does not occur. So, don't push the analogy too greatly, but with the arising of rain, or of clouds, with the appearance of clouds, rain can occur. When clouds exist, rain can happen. With the ceasing of the clouds, the rain ceases. When the clouds don't exist, there is no rain. Now, why this is the good news of Buddhism is when it's applied to suffering. When we realize that suffering has a cause, then we no longer see suffering as being inherently built into the structure of the universe. And you just have to kind of go along with it, go along for the ride with your suffering. If it has a cause, then it might be possible to address that cause. If it has a condition for it being there, it might be possible to remove that condition. And if you remove the condition and the cause, then the suffering won't be there. So if you have a thorn in your foot, you could just continue walking on it and letting the thorn go in deeper and deeper. Or the condition for the pain that you have, you see, is the thorn, and so you pull out the thorn. If you have a pain in your foot, you know you have a thorn in the foot, but you don't see the connection between the pain and the thorn, why would you bother bending over and pulling it out? It wouldn't occur to you. Just go along. It's unfortunate you have this pain, and that's the way it is. The universe was built to have foot pain, and I'll just keep walking with it. But that's silly, right? If you understand, most people, it's kind of obvious. You understand that if the sharp pain in your sole of your foot, you know, is probably coming from something that's not supposed to be there. You check, you see a thorn, and you pull it out. So with our psychological suffering, the idea is the same thing. And this is a difficult teaching to appreciate or to understand, and because sometimes human suffering is so great, and the conditions for it are not just in ourselves, but rather the conditions for our suffering in the world around us, it can be put salt in the wound of people's suffering to say that you're responsible for your suffering. But this is actually the teachings of Buddhism. You're not responsible for all the conditions for your suffering. That's why it's good to tell people to stop doing what they're doing to you sometimes. But you're responsible for the cause. And the difference between the condition and the cause is there's many conditions that might be in place, but those conditions don't necessarily translate to a result. The cause is that which is responsible for something arising. So, you know, to apologize for using the same analogy poorly, but the clouds, right? Clouds are the condition for rain, but I don't know if clouds are the cause of the rain. Sometimes they send up an airplane and they salt the clouds, and then somehow precipitation happens and it starts to rain. So somehow there has to be other atmospheric conditions, other things in place for the clouds to somehow translate into rain. So the clouds are the condition for the rain, but not necessarily the cause. Someone being unkind to you, being mean to you, doing something bad to you, might be the condition for your suffering, but it's not the necessary condition for you to suffer. As the schoolyard saying goes, sticks and bones can break my bones, but words can never touch me. So the words could be awful, but it's a wonderful taunt to taunt back to the other kids. Say, that's not touching me. It's not, you know, you're calling me, you're saying my mother wears army boots, it doesn't bother me. And that just irritates the other kids, right? Rather than being irritated yourself, you leave it with them. And the wonderful story, the Buddha did this when he was a Buddha. He didn't say it that way. But someone came to him who was angry with the Buddha. Came to the Buddha to express his anger, the Buddha said to him, if someone comes to your home with a gift and you refuse the gift, who then owns the gift? And the man said, in that case, the person who comes to give it still owns it. They still have it. It's their possession if it's not accepted. And the Buddha said, in the same way, I don't accept your anger. it remains with you. Isn't that nice? And I suppose that story implies that if you get angry in return when someone gets angry at you, or if you get upset or feel hurt, then you've accepted it. Do you have a role in that acceptance process? Or are you so focused on the other person's responsibility, blaming the other person, that you don't see the small little step that has to take, transferring step, where we have to accept it, we have to react to it, we have to respond to it, which is our responsibility. So to apply this teaching of dependent origination, this abstraction, this abstract thing, this and that, we have to begin looking at the details of our life. That's where the proof is. If we keep staying general, it's easy to come up with exceptions. It's easy to come up, well, it doesn't quite work in these kinds of ways. It doesn't really work with rains and clouds. Or to say that when clouds exist, there is rain, right? That's pretty obvious. It doesn't always exist, but so I shouldn't have used that analogy. So you can kind of go into those kinds of lines of arguments, just stay in the abstract. But the way that any spiritual teachings are useful for you is not whether you get involved with questions of whether it's true or false. It's not so interesting if it's true or false, I propose. What's most interesting is it useful for you? Does it help you in some way? And the way to discover that is to ask the question, in what circumstances is this helpful? So again, come back to the particular, and then use your ability to think creatively and ask yourself, where is it useful for me? Even the most outlandish teachings might in some little teeny, teeny little corner of your life be useful. And if you only say it's not useful, and that's not true, you might not benefit from it. But if you find that one little corner where it's beneficial, maybe, you get more benefit. So the idea of this dependent origination, this core teachings of Buddhism, is to look, where is it useful in me? How can I apply it in my life? And if you remember that the first kind of principle of Buddhism, I guess, the first problem is suffering, that's where we try to address it. How is this relevant to my suffering? And here we are back to ourselves. As opposed to looking, scanning out into the cosmos for a relationship with a cosmic principle or deity. So the Dhammapada begins, the first opening line of the Buddhist Bible. It begins by saying, all that we experience is preceded by mind, made by mind, created by mind, guided by mind. That the mind is at the beginning of all this. So the tendency of Buddhism is to look into our own minds. So if we're going to understand this dependent origination in our mind, where do we look? If we understand suffering in our own minds, where do we look? If we want to take responsibility for our suffering, where do we look for that responsibility in ourselves? And it has to do with our reactions and our responses. And the good news of dependent origination is that we can do something about it. If we can understand the cause for what brings about our suffering, then perhaps we can do something to eliminate that cause. And if we eliminate that cause, then the suffering is not there. So, what are some of the causes of suffering? There's an infinite variety, infinite numbers of them. The Buddhist tradition tends to give a generalized answer rather than giving the list of 10,000 different examples. And that generalization falls under the word of craving. That craving is the condition for suffering. And one of the ways of seeing that is that craving is an experience of compulsion, compulsive desire, that is unpleasant in and of itself. There's suffering just having it. And the more you're aware and really feel it, rather than being caught up in what you want, and really feel that what it's like in your body and mind to be in this compulsive grip of craving, it just feels kind of yucky. It feels like you've lost your freedom. Buddhism talks about sometimes being caught in the grips of craving as kind of like being in jail. You're not really, or being a slave, because you're not really in charge if your compulsions are in charge. It doesn't feel good. And so in and of itself it doesn't feel good, but craving has secondary problems. It can create tensions, it can create disappointments, it can create grief, it can be the source of anger, of hostility, it can be a source of a tremendous amount of secondary kind of suffering in our lives. And if we see that the starting point of suffering in all its varieties is in craving, then in principle at least we know that if that craving is no longer there, perhaps all the things that follow in its wake won't be there as well. And so the teaching of dependent origination is to go back and look, where do you find the clinging, the craving that gives birth to this suffering? And so then there's an expanded teaching of dependent origination that many people know as the principle of dependent origination, which is a 12-fold step. Sometimes referred to as a kind of chain of reactions that are the genesis or the background for when we suffer. And I won't go through all of them, but one of the conditions that's said to be the genesis of suffering is ignorance. That if you suffer, there's something you don't understand. Isn't that nice? So that means that when you suffer, I think what's appropriate is a teeny bit of humility. Maybe I don't quite understand. A little bit of healthy doubt. Maybe there's something I don't understand here. Sometimes suffering is made worse when we're absolutely convinced we understand. This is how it is. But maybe we don't understand. So ignorance is considered part of it. The other, second kind of condition for the rising of suffering is our basic disposition. The attitudes with which we go into the world with. The attitudes with which we see the world and experience the world. It's called dispositions or mental formations. And this is so central to this whole enterprise in Buddhism. And Buddhism says that the basic dispositions and attitudes you have color how you perceive the world, color the quality of your consciousness. Something as fundamental as how we're conscious of the world around us is not an innocent thing, but rather it's something that's been conditioned by our dispositions. And then based on those, how the consciousness and perceptions are conditioned by ignorance and attitudes, that affects how we perceive, touch, meet the world around us. And how we meet it affects how we feel about it. And how we feel about it affects what we want to do about it. And what we want to do about it affects what we crave, cling to. And what we cling and crave is then gives birth to eventually to suffering, to the steps that lead to suffering. So, this is more abstraction. Apologize. The idea is, how do you find it here? The principle, as I said earlier, is when that exists, this arises. I think this, with these words, that and this, are very important. They're meant to be, I like the word this. Where's this? It's here. Here. Not to take these ideas home that I'm saying and then consider them at home, but how are they true for you now, here at IMC, listening to this talk? If you would now not just listen to what I'm trying to say, but also look at your mind. What's happening with you? What are the ideas? What are the attitudes? What's available to you? What is the state of your being? What's it like to be present for you here and now? Are there ways in which you, in some maybe hopefully subtle, weak ways, are suffering right now, uncomfortable right now? And if you are, and you're spending your time looking at your watch, thinking, when's this guy going to stop talking? Then you're missing an opportunity. And the opportunity is to take responsibility for your discomfort, for your impatience, for whatever is going on. What do you have to turn towards and look inside of you? What do you have to find? So you can release something, relax something, and so you hear more fully. In this moment, now. And if you're not suffering, which I hope none of you are, what is it, if you stay here in the particulars of this life, in the being awake and present here and now, if you feel like being here and now is of value, what's it like for you to be awake, to be alert, to be conscious right now? What's this experience like for you? If it's not about a transcendent reality, it's not about a transcendent experience, it's not about having a relationship to something external, but it's about the lived experience of right now, the taste of what it's like to be alive now, being conscious now. What's that taste like for you? What is it feeling like? And perhaps, to give you a little taste, maybe, or little kind of give you something to, that maybe can point to the poignancy of what's available here and now, just being present. I'll tell you a little bit of, and I think I feel like it's important to tell some of you, that some of you know that Victor Medina, who's been part of our community for many years, very big-time participant in our community, is right now dying. He's been dying for over 2 years. He has always one of the wonderful people who flunked out of hospice already once. But now he's back in hospice. And they suspect that he's probably going to die in the next couple of days, very soon. He's starting to stay alive long enough for his daughter to come back from abroad. And she's supposed to arrive at the airport around 11 o'clock this morning. And so I've been visiting him this last week and talking with him. And he's a happy and peaceful man. And you go into his house, his home, and there's an atmosphere in that house right now of calm, of peace, and of love. It's quite something to go in there and feel it. I think, you know, he has the fortune of dying slowly, so that there's been a lot of time for his family to gather and be, and just be, and there's not much to do. So, you know, some of them are doing their life, some of the normal things of their life that they do, but they're also not doing much and just hanging out. And so yesterday I was sitting with Victor talking, and we were talking about the poignancy of this moment. And the idea that for him, this moment, one of the important things that he's learned from doing this practice of mindfulness, Buddhism, is the refuge, the meaningfulness, the importance of being present in the moment as the moment occurs. And now, as he's dying, this is what's supporting him, supporting his family and everyone, just to be here for this moment. And in this moment, there is no time. At this moment, there's something that people sometimes feel or sense, the timelessness of this moment. And for Victor, he feels this timelessness. There is no time. And he talked about how time is a concept. The future, the past, are ideas. And he's learned not to get pulled into the world of ideas and concepts, but to stay present in this moment for itself in an open, receptive willingness. Just stay in the moment. Come back to the moment. Concepts are useful, an important part of our lives. But from a certain perspective, the stories we tell, the ideas we live by, the concepts that we try to apply to the world are kind of like, it's kind of like trying to paint with watercolors on a moving river. Isn't that something? It says something about concepts and about this moment. If you're really in the moment, the concepts. But what was not a concept for Victor is certainly his physical discomfort, which he feels from time to time. He talks about, it's quite something to talk to someone who feels physical discomfort, but then his mind seems to be at peace. But the sense of peace, the calm, and the love, the care, the friendship that's there. All these beautiful qualities are there in that timeless moment. So I told Victor that since it was so available to him, he really could feel it. I said to him, in this timeless moment, there is no distance. In this timeless moment, there's no distance between you and the Buddha. You share this timeless moment with the Buddha. And you share it with your family. And after you've died, your family will share this timeless moment with you. In this timeless moment, there is no distance. He smiled. So we start with general principles. Suffering, cause of suffering, possibility of the cessation of suffering. We engage in a practice of bringing ourselves into the present moment, here and now. One of the things Victor kept saying to me in last week was how extremely important ethics is, sila, living a life of integrity. Isn't that nice? This timeless moment, integrity, kind of go hand in hand. So there's a path, a way to engage in this path. And as the awareness gets strong, as we let go, as we find ourselves here, then some of the things, the causes and conditions, some of the graspings and cravings we have are only graspings and cravings to concepts and ideas. In fact, one argument can be made that unless you're hanging on to the railing of top of Yosemite, Half Dome, something like that, when we crave, we only crave to ideas and concepts. And to be able to see through the veil of concepts, to let go of that clinging in such a way that we relax and settle in to this moment. And find that being alive and present in this moment is the most satisfying and meaningful and peaceful place to be. So that perhaps now, or perhaps when you're on your deathbed, your gift to the world, to others, just as it's gift, Victor's gift to his family and friends, your gift will be your ability to be at peace, calm, open, heartfelt, moment to moment, while you're still alive. Isn't that a nice gift? So, thank you for today, for this, and for those of you who know Victor, probably once he's passed, I don't know, we'll probably put a notice up on the What's New page at IMC's website, so that, I don't know how else to let everyone know. Probably people want to know. And now we have a potluck. And perhaps as a transition to a potluck, so either you're not just stunned by the timeless moment or by death or whatever, I think it might be nice if you gently, kindly, respectfully, turn to someone next to you and just say hello and say something a little bit. Especially people are new, so they feel welcomed. And then we can have our potluck in a few minutes. Thank you.